You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In theory, a democracy is a political system where everyone is equal before the law and everyone is able to exercise equal freedoms and rights. But there's often a big gap between theory and practice. A new book has just been published exploring one aspect of that gap. The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation, has been issued this month by UBC Press. It describes a half-century of state-sanctioned and state-directed attacks against Canadian gay and bisexual men and women. Gary Kinsman is the co-author of the book, and he's joined me by phone from Sudbury. Hello, Gary.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Now, how did the state characterize queers in order to define them as risks to security?
Okay, well, you have to think back to the context of the Cold War years in Canada and the United States. During that period of time, first of all, queer people were identified as being fellow travelers of communists because we defied political, social, and class boundaries. But more specifically, in the Canadian context, they defined us as having a so-called character weakness that made us supposedly susceptible to blackmail from agents of the Soviet Union. It's really interesting in terms of our research, our discussion with people who were interrogated and purged, that they report that the only people who ever tried to blackmail them during this period of time with the RCMP itself, who tried to get the names of other lesbians and gay men from them. So the ostensible reason for going after lesbians and gay men was that we were a national security risk because we had a character weakness and could therefore be susceptible to blackmail and give state secrets to the Soviet Union. What it really was about was a war for heterosexual normality and a way of trying to expel lesbians and gays from the fabric of the nation, constructing heterosexuality as the only sort of national, secure and safe sexuality.
And for the people who were so identified as national security threats for being gay, what were the consequences for them?
Basically, what it meant was you were put on lists by the RCMP if they established that you were a confirmed homosexual. Especially in the 1960s, you would entirely lose your position. Later on in the civil service, you might have been demoted to a lower position in the civil service, but thousands of people lost their jobs. In the military, obviously, this continued into the early 1990s, with anyone who was identified as being lesbian or gay being purged from the armed forces. So lots of people lost their jobs. Their promising careers were destroyed. Lots of people were forced to inform on their friends. Lots of people were interrogated. Lots of people were watched and spied upon by the RCMP, and the Canadian government even tried to develop what was referred to as the fruit machine in the 1960s to try to supposedly scientifically determine who was lesbian or gay, and if they were lesbian or gay, they were going to be denied jobs or would be removed from their positions in the civil service.
Can you get in a little more detail about this fruit machine? What was it exactly?
For sure. In the early 1960s, there was an attempt to use psychological and psychiatric knowledge to try to find a supposedly scientific way of determining who was lesbian or gay or not. Some of the pressures for this actually came from the RCMP itself, who was experiencing growing resistance from the homosexual informant that they'd had previously giving them names in Ottawa. People, because of the development of queer solidarity and queer community, were starting to refuse to cooperate with the RCMP. So there were a number of different forces that came together, and a reliance also in the security regime on psychological knowledge. So they hired Dr. Professor Wake from Carleton University, a psychology professor who was chair of the department at one point there, to develop this detection technology. The center of it was what he referred to as the pupillary response test. They would show individuals images of naked men or naked women, and they would take pictures of people's pupils. And supposedly, if the pupil dilated, it showed in relationship to, for instance, a naked image of a man, that you had some sort of homosexual propensity. That's what they tried to do. It never, of course, worked. There were lots of contradictions in the research, but the Canadian government spent 4 years, including Health and Welfare Canada, spent 4 years trying to develop this fruit machine technology. The name fruit machine came from the RCMP officers who were going to be recruited as the so-called normal control group for the study. And many of them feared that even though they were recruited as sort of normal heterosexuals for the study, they would be found out to be fruits as a result of the detection technology and series of tests. So that's where the name itself actually comes from.
Now, in the 1960s and so on, the pretense was communism. But in the 1990s, what excuse did the government give for this sort of discrimination?
Well, I mean, you're probably familiar with the official policy of excluding lesbians and gay men from the military, only being ended by a Supreme Court challenge in 1992 in the Michelle Douglas case. So until the early 1990s, they were claiming within the military, and a little bit earlier the policies were changed in CSIS and the RCMP, but they claimed that lesbians and gay men still were, you know, risks to national security because we supposedly had something to hide and therefore were vulnerable to blackmail. Still to this day, it is possible for CSIS to refuse to give someone a security clearance if they are perceived as having something to hide. The other thing you have to remember is that the process of a security investigation to get a higher level of security clearance is a very complicated process. They talk to all sorts of people in your life. If you have any fear that you or your partner might be outed to people who might have devastating consequences in your life as a result, say a family member who doesn't know or a parent who doesn't know, this still is a pretty threatening situation. So there's still lots of problems relating to security investigations in relationship to lesbians and gay men. But it should be pointed out that because of the organizing of the lesbian and gay liberation movements, or queer liberation movements, things did begin to relax in parts of the public service in the 1970s and into the 1980s. And the last sort of holdout in terms of this sort of strong-line, hardcore position against queers being part of their institutions with the military, the RCMP, and CSIS. It's also important to point out that, you know, in terms of our research, it's not just a story of victimization, of sort of like lesbians and gay men being passively victimized by the national security regime and the RCMP. We've collected wonderful tales and stories of resistance, and even in the 1960s, it was possible for lesbians and gay men to refuse to cooperate with the RCMP and to actually create obstacles and problems for the RCMP. For instance, David tells us, this is a pseudonym we've given to one individual we interviewed, David tells us about the basement tavern of the Lord Elgin Hotel in Ottawa in 1964, which was a hangout for gay men, where the RCMP would send informers or operatives in who would put newspapers up in front of them, and then they would take pictures of people through holes cut in these newspapers. Well, the response of people in the bar was not to hide under the tables and run for cover. It was actually to turn towards that individual, act like they were taking pictures back at that individual, basically showing in a very campy way that they'd been discovered and that they were not welcome in that environment. So major tales of sort of resistance and non-cooperation that we've collected in the book as well.
Now, you just mentioned this story of resistance, and the book actually begins with stories of people who were spied upon or who lost their job because of these security campaigns. Why did you begin in this way?
Well, part of the method of approach that we use is called institutional ethnography, and we start from the standpoints and the experiences of the people who were most directly affected by the national security campaign. So we don't start in the world of the official discourse where lesbians and gay men were constructed as being some sort of national security risk. Instead, we start off with the experiences of the people who were persecuted and oppressed and suppressed as a result of these national security campaigns. Starting from that standpoint, we then begin to go on to critically interrogate the official documents that we've been able to get released under the Access to Information Program, and also a series of state security officials that we were able to interview, who we were able to learn a lot from, but we started our inquiry from the vantage point of those people who were most directly affected. And for us, this is really crucial because we want to break free from and break through the constraints of national security as an ideological practice. In our view, national security is everywhere and always a practice that is about excluding lots of people and only including some people in the fabric of the nation. And clearly that happened during the Canadian War on Queers, where basically queer people were expelled from the fabric of the nation. It's happening in a different way right now in the context of the so-called War on Terror, where Arab and Muslim-identified individuals are being expelled from the fabric of the nation.
In the book, you give one example of the Olympics in Montreal. At that time, they had something called the Committee of the Olympic Games, which I guess would be something similar to what we have here in Vancouver, VANOC. They wanted action taken, how did the authorities respond to their actions?
Well, that's a very interesting sort of part of the story that we record in the Canadian War on Queers as part of a really important history of resistance. In preparation for the 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal, another social cleansing operation was engaged in, again against poor and homeless people and people on the left, but also against the queer communities. And there was major attempts using body house legislation to close down bars and bathhouses, both in Montreal and in Ottawa. But what was really interesting was, even though those campaigns initially seemed to be being successful, both in Ottawa and Montreal, people eventually came together and were able to organize such levels of resistance that they were able to turn back that part of the social cleansing campaign. So it was actually a major victory won against the anti-queer social cleansing campaign. One of the reasons we draw attention to this in the book is clearly this reminds us a lot of what's happening in preparation for the Winter 2010 Olympics in Vancouver and Whistler, where, of course, poor and homeless people are being socially cleansed, left activists and anti-Olympic activists are being put under surveillance and having their rights restricted. And we think it's important to remember the queer resistance in 1975, 1976, to the cleanup before the Summer Olympics, to try to reignite queer and other forms of opposition to the types of security surveillance that's going on in relationship to the upcoming Winter Olympics.
How exactly did it change the policy in Ottawa in regards to discrimination against queers?
There was no direct relationship there, but there certainly was in Quebec because of the mobilizations against the social cleansing prior to the Montreal Summer Olympics. There was a basis built for resistance to future bar and bath raids. So there was a raid on the Trucks Bar in 1977 in Montreal, and there was a massive rebellion of 2,000 people in the streets. Shortly after that, the Parti Québécois government very quietly added sexual orientation protection to the Human Rights Code in Quebec, which was the first jurisdiction within the Canadian state on a province-wide basis to do that. So there were major repercussions there. The other thing that should be pointed out is our resistance to sexual policing, which oftentimes merged with the national security campaigns, and in some ways our successful resistance to that, including the resistance to the bath raids in Toronto in the early 1980s, did certainly help to set the stage for a turning back of some of the more vicious forms of sexual policing and national security that have been directed at queer people in various places across the country.
Now you've alluded to the war on terror. Can the war on queers teach us anything about these new security campaigns that we're seeing in relation to the war on terror?
Well, part of what we point out is that national security as an ideological practice always operates to exclude some people from the fabric of the nation. The actual people who are being excluded now has changed, although it should be pointed out that lots of queer people of color and queer people who identified as being Arab or Muslim are certainly being affected by the so-called war on terror. Many of the same techniques are being used, you know, lists of people, trying to get people to inform on their friends or acquaintances. Many of the same tactics are being used. Obviously, there's new technologies of surveillance that are now able to be used that were not available, for instance, in the 60s and 70s. But certainly the basic features of the campaign are that you identify a group of people as being security risks, you write them out of the fabric of the nation, you then can deny them their human and civil rights, and certainly that went on in the context of the Canadian War on Queers, and it's certainly going on in the context of the so-called War on Terror right now, and also what we might want to describe as the War on Subversion in terms of the surveillance campaigns and security campaigns against global justice activists, Indigenous rights activists and anti-Olympic activists right now, as well as sometimes anti-poverty activists. In all of those cases, national security is something we need to be really suspicious of and to ask critical questions about. We always need to ask, what nation is being talked about here? Whose security is being talked about here? Because what we always see is that national security is used by people in positions of power to actually try to disadvantage groups of people who experience forms of oppression and marginalization in their lives. So it's really important to remember that, and especially for queer people who were major targets of these national security campaigns from the late 50s through to the 1990s, to remember that we really need to be giving as much support as we can to people who are under attack in terms of the so-called war on terror or the so-called war on subversion that's going on right now.
Thank you for talking with us today, Gary.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Gary Kinsman. He is a professor at Laurentian University in Sudbury and the co-author, along with Patricia Gentile, of The Canadian War on Queers, published by UBC Press.